All right, cool. Thanks a lot. So I thought it would be a travesty if no one gave a chalkboard talk for you while you were here at Perimeter Institute, so I will give a chalkboard talk. The other reason I wanted to give a chalkboard talk is I looked at all the slides I had, and then I got really intimidated by a room full of people that make like beautiful graphics and stuff to describe science, and I'm like, no freaking way am I going to do that. This is just going to be an embarrassment. So a few things to understand about the culture of chalk talks. Number one, if I write down more than like three or four things and I don't get a question, I will feel insulted in this building. So this is your opportunity to just stop me, ask questions, and if there's something I say that you want to know more about that looks interesting to you, then just ask me to say more, please. There's no way I will get through all of this, and I understand that right now. So we're just going to talk about some fun stuff. All right, so I want to talk about the physics of cosmic acceleration, which I think encompasses a lot of cosmology, both early universe and late universe cosmology, and it contains some of the biggest mysteries in cosmology. So I won't talk about a lot of answers today, but I'm just going to spit out things that have confused me and much of all of the community for many years. So no answers, but some mysteries. So there are at least two distinct phases of cosmic acceleration that we think happened in so far in the history of the universe. So here's time. And here's space, and here is my bad artist rendering of what has happened so far. So the first phase of cosmic acceleration we think happened in the deep past is cosmic inflation. This is like the prequel to the observable universe that sets the stage for everything that happens later that we get to directly measure and interact with, okay? And this phase of cosmic accelerated expansion took things from the scale of atoms to about the size of galaxies, okay? So it is an epoch that inflated, hence the name inflation, a little patch about the size of an atom into something about as big as a galaxy. Yeah.
So the universe is everywhere. So I really have a hard time visualizing or understanding what it means for the whole universe to be the size of that. Do you mean like the observable universe now is compacted down to the atomic size?
Yep. So catchphrase, everyone in the room remember this, is what I teach all of my intro cosmology students. The Big Bang is a time, not a place. Okay, so at some early time, the universe could have been infinitely big for all we know, right? And at that early time, if I take a little piece of the universe about the size of an atom, it could be here, or it could be here, or it could be here, that little piece will grow into something about the size of a galaxy.
No one ever says that qualification.
Yeah.
How settled is the final size of the inflationary epoch? Because I've heard Melon, I've heard solar system, I've heard galaxy.
Yep.
Are we converging on galaxy at this point?
It totally depends on the energy scales involved. And right now, given what we know, I can only tell you a lower bound on how big that thing is. It had to be at least as small as, say, an atom, right?
But at the end.
Yeah. No, at the beginning.
Okay, so
at the beginning. At the end. There's also an uncertainty there because this uncertainty has to do with what energy scale is associated with this accelerated expansion. And the uncertainty here of how big it eventually gets has to do with how hot did the universe get after inflation. So the universe grows. In some sense, inflation is really cold, although I'll tell you it's actually really hot in a minute, so it'll confuse you. But so the universe grows, it's really cold, and then at some point this has to end because we're not still undergoing the expansion from an atom to a galaxy over, you know, like 10 to the minus some big number seconds. So it had to end, and the universe gets really hot. That's an event called reheating. And depending on how hot it gets, will determine how big I need to grow the universe in order to be consistent with everything we see. So don't know, but this is an informed guess that's pretty much consistent with what we know. Yeah, okay.
When you say end, I guess you don't mean a discontinuous end. You mean it can, there's some function from it.
Hold your question. Yeah. All right. Okay, and then lots of stuff happens, and I'll leave it to Jesse to describe all the stuff that happens. Okay, really interesting stuff, but not accelerating expansion, but expansion. And then kind of like now, or pretty recently in the cosmic history, the universe has started to accelerate again. So this expansion is now accelerating. If we are, like, we have a name for this. It's like an epoch, inflation. This, we need a name for this. I've decided, like, when I started writing these notes, it was called, I don't know, dark energy domination. It's kind of a, we need a better name. Okay, yeah. Anyway, so recently the universe started accelerating again, okay? Before I go in to describe, like, some of the physics of this, I just wanted to highlight some of the questions associated with these two distinct epochs that are kind of the big unsolved mysteries of cosmology. So we'll start with dark energy domination. So why this rate of expansion? If you've heard about it before, that's kind of like the cosmological constant problem. There's problems, actually, so I'll just put an S there. It's a bit associated with this, but it's a bit more detailed, which is why now? Like, why only in the recent past has the universe started to undergo acceleration? Why was there this intermittent phase where it wasn't?
Why is Matt Johnson asking why now?
Yeah. And then the other thing is, like, does it last? So if we extrapolate in the future, is this going to end or just keeps undergoing accelerated expansion? Okay, so then, you know, here on this side for inflation, like, how did it begin and end? Kind of coming to your question, like, did it end immediately or slowly? You know, like, what happened? What did that look like? Here's a big question, because I'm like an archaeologist, right? I just study these records of the past, and I try and figure out, piece together what happened, but they're imperfect and incomplete records, so there's kind of a fundamental question of like how testable is this? And as I'll explain in a little bit, not a lot of information is actually left over from this period, or the information is very simple. It doesn't tell us, it's not very informative. So how testable is it? And then, you know, we intersect with all sorts of stuff regarding quantum and gravity. Okay, so there's a lot of unsettled things here. Yeah.
For the recent dark energy domination, how different is that? Like, how much does that deviate from if there had been no acceleration? Like, how much bigger is the universe than it would have been if it just continued on the pre-dark energy expansion rate?
Right now, if I had to make like a rough guess, maybe a factor of 30% bigger. I don't know. It's not like an order of magnitude bigger.
It's very different from inflation.
Yeah. Depends on how long it lasts, though. But for now, not terribly much. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Can I ask an honest question? I don't know the answer to it. Actually, maybe for you and Katie. How seriously should we be now taking these problems, these early high-redshift problems that we're seeing? Yeah, you know, as part of the question in here.
like
these supermassive, apparent supermassive black holes.
Becky is totally looking to this.
Okay, yes.
The supermassive black holes in particular, I just don't think really understand supermassive black hole growth. I wouldn't worry about quasars yet, because I think it's a whole different problem of like direct collapse black holes in the very early universe from clouds of gas just giving stuff down. As for the JWST results, I think we're going to find out that the photometric redshifts are wildly wrong.
Okay.
There was something that came out recently of a redshift 12 that was actually a redshift 5 when you got a spectrum of it. So I think a lot of that will resolve with further observations.
Okay.
And I think the black holes thing is just, we need to understand black holes more than a cosmology problem.
Okay.
Okay, so the big questions, but I don't have any answers to any of these questions, so I'm gonna like try and give you some answers to some smaller questions. So I want to do three things, and I probably won't be able to, but you can ask me later. So one big question is what kind of stuff makes this happen? Okay, I think I can get there. I want to talk a little bit how these epochs might begin and end. And then I'll kind of end by saying something. Like rampant speculation, okay? But things that I think are interesting and important questions, okay? Okay, so that's my goal. Let's see how far we get. Number one, so what causes it? The one equation I've told you I would write down, here it is. We need a model, right? Okay, so our best model is general relativity to describe the universe. And I was told from your scavenger hunt you needed an equation and like an explanation of the equation. And so everyone gets to tick this off their scavenger hunt, okay? So this is the Einstein's equation. It's deceptively simple. This is really like 10 partial differential equations. It's terrible and no one knows how to solve it. But there it is.
What's going on after the 8 pi there?
That's the Newton's constant.
Oh, okay.
So let me tell you what these things are. I haven't done that yet, right? Curvature. Curvature actually includes curvature in space and time. And so curvature in time is the thing that tells us about how the universe is going to expand. Okay, so that's the left side, how the universe expands in a second. Sweet.
I don't see a problem.
How are you going to mark this scavenger hunt? You're going to go through
oral examination.
Call it Mach's principle.
Okay, there's Newton's constant. That's the thing that converts this thing, which is the description of all the matter and energy that might inhabit the universe, tells me how to translate the stuff to curvature. Okay, that's like the strength of gravity, if you will. Right? How much curvature does some amount of stuff create? Okay, so that's our model. That's our best model. There's another part of the model. Let me write one thing down, and then I'll answer your question. So I'm gonna write it down here. Plus symmetries, okay? So we don't know actually how to do anything in general with this. You need to make some assumptions. And the basic symmetries that we assume about the universe is that it's the same everywhere, it's homogeneous, and it looks the same in every direction. It's isotropic. What? No, I'm gonna put it in here, because I can do that. That's the type of stuff. There's nothing fundamental about the cosmological constant tells me I can't put it in here. We'll get there in a second. Specialists are not allowed to ask questions at this point in my talk. But you can ask later. Yeah. But you had a question.
Yeah, I tried to visualize when you said that the curvature of time was the rate of expansion.
Yeah.
don't understand. Sorry.
That's okay. That's just cool words. So, you know, is second derivatives of things is what we mean by curvature. So things can change, you know, like, or no, like a bowl, right? How do we know the bowl is facing up or down? We compute not the slope, but the rate at which the slope changes. And if it's negative, the bowl's this way. If it's positive, the bowl's this way, right? So similarly, if space is expanding, then we could think about that as a second derivative in time.
Oh, simple as that.
Yep. Okay. And so that's secretly what's living in this symbol. Second derivatives of space and time, or the rate of change in space and time. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So that's our basic model, right? And then the output of that basic model is with these assumptions, so that the universe is the same everywhere and looks the same in every direction, then kind of you only have one degree of freedom, which is if I look at a little piece of the universe, like a box or square, and I go forward in time, then that box or square can grow by a factor called the scale factor. And this is the thing that describes the expansion of the universe. And it's just that the distance between any two points grows by this factor. That's a function of time, okay? So that's the output. That is the whole like output of this terrible equation with these symmetries becomes what is this function of time? Because it tells me how the universe expands. So then there's the stuff, right? And you can see from this equation, this stuff tells me how the universe expands. So let's think about normal stuff, like particles, okay? If I had three particles in a box and I made the box twice as big, you know, the density would go down by a factor of, well, an eighth, two cubed. The distance between these two points, any two points, is just growing, then the density gets smaller. So normal stuff dilutes, okay? And if I put in stuff to this equation that dilutes, what I'll find is that normal stuff gives rise to decelerating universes. And so if I want to make that accelerated expansion happen, I need to come up with some weird stuff, some not normal stuff. If I want to get acceleration, we need something that has a property that is kind of non-diluting.
I disagree.
Sure.
There is another option that was taken by Einstein in 1917, which is just, you know, it's a little bit different thing than just what you're assuming.
This is my assumption. It's this GR. This is my assumption.
So my, no, that's not true. GR in the textbook that I wrote in GR. It's not about names. You have another option, which is change model and use what I call GR in my textbook. Many other people wrote textbook on GR and called GR something else.
Okay, well, these are my assumptions. So with these assumptions, this is what comes out.
Yes. You're listing options. So another option is to have a better model, which is Einstein GR with different.
That's fine, Carlo, but this is how I teach my undergrads, and we're going to stick to this model. Yeah, I disagree, but okay. Yeah,
I've been stuck on the question of the name. You've got inflation and then the rapid expansion period.
Yeah.
I'm leaning toward blowout.
Blowout. Let's write it down.
I like that.
Okay, so I'm going to say this. This is what I would teach my undergrads. So if I have perfect non-dilution, so something that just does not dilute at all as the universe expands, then this function is exponential, where the E folding is set by some parameter. It's H. It's called the Hubble parameter. And that's kind of the important scale in all this, right? That's the one dimensionful number that, that determines how everything happens in a universe that has this perfectly non-diluting stuff. OK, so what kind of stuff does not dilute? So let's take space. And if I just put a number at any point in space, say the number 2.
Why 2?
I just picked it at random. It could be 3. It could be 7.546. It could be anything. It's a number, right? So it's a number. So when I imbue every point in space with a number, that's got a name. That's called a scalar field. And if every point in space has a number and I grow space, well, that grown space or the distance between, you know, whatever, it's always got the same number. So this is a non-diluting stuff. It's just a property of space. A property of space is non-diluting stuff, OK? And so, you know, there are some options. So this could be non-dynamical. That's got a name. The cosmological constant. So if I just imbue every point with a number and it's not allowed to change from 2 to something else, that's the definition of a cosmological constant. And that causes exactly this type of expansion. Okay. Or it could be dynamical. Okay. And that's got different names depending on what epoch we're talking about. The type of stuff might then be called an inflaton if it happened in the early universe. And then there's like a bunch of models in the late universe, but you might call it something like quintessence. Yeah. And so this is a scalar field, right? So it's something that can be dynamical. So it can change in time or it could change in space. Okay? But it still can have this property that it's non-diluting. Okay. Actually, scalar fields are like the multi-purpose tool of cosmology because you can pretty much do anything with them. Cosmologists are big fans of scalar fields. So there's that. And then I'll just put in the box because it is a good point. We can think of more exotic modifications of general relativity than the ones you're referring to.
No.
Yeah.
Don't put in my mouth. No, I'm referring to the theory of Einstein that everybody calls general relativity, which is G mu nu is R mu nu minus 1/2 G mu nu R plus lambda G mu nu.
Mm-hmm.
That's not okay. Exotic. You call it exotic.
No, I'm just talking about the Friedman equations.
No, but you said I referred to something exotic.
Okay, well, also this. Sure. Okay, so that's how you make one way of making non-diluting stuff, right? Okay, scalar field. We could talk about how it begins and ends, but maybe I'll mention something on the crazier side, because it's a little more interesting. And I want to do this to set up a little bit what Jesse might be talking about. Which is, how do we get the seeds of the primordial density fluctuations that grow up into galaxies? Okay, so these seeds for structure one way to get them is from this accelerated expansion that happens in the early universe during the epoch of inflation. Okay. So here's a weird property of these universes that have exact non-dilution, which is that they have an event horizon. Okay. But they're like the opposite of a black hole. So for a black hole, you fall inside the event horizon. You can never make it out. For these types of event horizons that happen in a cosmological space-time, if I've got friend A and friend B, then they can move away from each other. Okay, but it could be that the universe is expanding at this rate, and now friend B cannot actually make it back to friend A ever. Okay. And so when they cross some imaginary boundary called this event horizon, that's the point of no return, where if they strayed sufficiently far away, they'd never be able to come back and meet with their friend A. Okay. And just like black holes, well, people have thought about how you might interpret this event horizon. And one way, one thing you might remember from black holes, there's the phenomenon of Hawking radiation. So we like to imbue the event horizon of a black hole with sort of thermodynamic properties. And you can imbue these cosmological event horizons with similar thermodynamic properties. Okay. And so kind of beautifully, if we think about the entropy, and this doesn't count as a full equation because it's half pictures. So the entropy of the cosmological horizon, or a black hole event horizon for that matter, is basically I put little tiles that are the Planck area in size, and I count how many of these tiles I can fit on the event horizon. And that's the entropy, okay? One way of interpreting the entropy, it's like the number of degrees of freedom of a system, okay? And so the number of degrees of freedom of this cosmological space-time might be able to be thought of as just how many of these Planck-sized tiles I put on. Cool fact. So this is also kind of like, you know, the number of bits that I need to describe this system. And I don't know why I never did this before, but if you just plug in like the upper bound on the energy scale, which means that this thing is the smallest it can possibly be, that's 100 terabytes. So like this inflationary volume, this horizon volume, you know, like you could fit it on a hard disk, like the description of it. That's pretty cool, actually.
I guarantee if you talk to the public about that, they're going to say we're in a simulation.
Totally. Well, maybe we could simulate it, right? Yeah, I mean, if it's only 100 terabytes. Yeah, I have one more thing to say. So there's an entropy. There's also a temperature. And the temperature during inflation is really hot, this Hawking temperature, 10 to the 25 degrees Kelvin. The energy density is also really huge. So this is a fairly small fluctuation, if I think about the fluctuations in the density. Those are one part per million, roughly. Okay. So if I think about this inflationary period, as this small system, right? This is like way less than Avogadro's number, so this is really way simpler than describing a gram of matter. The fact that it's a small system with not a lot of degrees of freedom and it's really hot means that there you're gonna find a lot of fluctuations, okay? And it's these fluctuations in this thermodynamic system that end up growing into the galaxies and stuff that Jesse is going to describe for you. And I'm happy to talk about other stuff with you some other time, but I think I'm done. And I should turn the mic over.
It's just a matter of plugging
Sun. All right. So yeah, I'm gonna follow up Matt's talk with a discussion of how we take descriptions we have of the fundamental physics describing cosmology, dark matter, dark energy, and how we test them using observations of the large-scale universe. So I kind of work at the intersection of theory and data analysis, lately mainly working on a galaxy survey called the Dark Energy Survey. And so for Perimeter, while I count as a theorist within the Dark Energy Survey collaboration, at Perimeter I'm about as close as you can get to an observer experimentalist. So we're going to be talking about what we do with data here. So between Luna's dark matter talk yesterday and Matt's talk here, we kind of are set up with this picture. So this is a pie chart showing the fraction of the matter and energy density in the universe made up of different components. And this is a picture we put together as a scientific community over the past several decades. And it's really the fact that we're able to put this picture together is an accomplishment of field of cosmology, of being able to understand the properties of the universe in this way. But it's also really striking in that there's only 5% of this pie labeled here as visible matter, which is stuff that we really know how to describe on a fundamental level. So the rest being dark matter and dark energy are things that we can constrain the properties of, but we don't really know at a fundamental level. And learning more about that represents some of the biggest open questions in cosmology or in physics in general. So we would like to know what the dark energy driving the accelerated expansion is. Sort of simpler questions you can ask is, does it really have the properties of this cosmological constant, constant energy density associated with empty space? Or are there some dynamics? Or could the accelerating expansion we see be a hint that maybe we need to extend our description of gravity beyond general relativity in some way? And with dark matter, sort of the simplest description we have for that is this thing called cold dark matter. So the idea that it's made up of some massive particles that are non-relativistic. But as you heard yesterday, there's a bunch of different ideas for what this could be. So if you make some assumptions about the stuff in the universe, so dark energy and dark matter, and put that together with a couple other assumptions, you can get a cosmological model, which is basically all you need to describe the large-scale properties of the universe. So we've got our pie chart of stuff in the universe. We need a theory of gravity, which the best working theory we have is general relativity, performs remarkably well over every test we've been able to throw at it. You need some information about how fast the universe is currently expanding, and you need some description of what density fluctuations looked like in the early universe, perhaps seeded by some model of inflation. Given these things, you can make predictions for what the universe is going to look like, and sweeping a lot of details under a rug, we can measure two things. We can measure how the expansion rate of the universe has changed over time, and we can look at how what the density fluctuations look like and how they've evolved from tiny fluctuations in a mostly uniform early universe to big structures of galaxies and groups of galaxies and like lecture halls that we're all very happy exist. So I'm going to talk briefly kind of through these two concepts, and then I'm going to dive into a little bit more detail of talking about how we measure structure growth using an analysis that I've worked on in the dark energy survey as an example. All right, so we'll start with expansion. As we've got a nice primer already here. Our description of gravity general relativity relates the behavior of spacetime to the matter and energy occupying that spacetime. And the behavior of spacetime includes an overall expansion. And so if we can constrain how the expansion of the universe has evolved over time, that can inform our knowledge of what the matter and energy contents are. And going the other way, having a description of dark matter, dark energy stuff in the universe gives us a description of expansion history. So we're looking at this now from the point of view is we want to measure expansion to constrain the models of dark matter and dark energy and anything else you might add to your cosmic pie. We measure expansion history by relating measurements of distance to objects in the universe to their velocities. And so this sketch of a plot here is showing a straight line, which is what you would see if the universe was expanding at a constant rate. So like doubling at the same, or if the time derivative of the scale factor that Matt was showing you was constant in time. And here, so velocity is on the horizontal axis, distance is on the vertical axis, and here, something that's twice as far away from you as another object is gonna be moving twice as fast away, just because there's twice as much space between you and the distant object.
Is this distance like now in our frame of reference, or what reference frame are we using?
There are a couple different ways of quantifying it, but roughly speaking, it's how long has, what I'm kind of describing it here is how long has it taken light to get from an object to us? And the fact that objects that are further away, their light has been traveling to us for a longer time is why looking at how expansion, looking at this relation tells us about expansion history. So when we're looking at objects that are further away, that light's been traveling for a longer time, so they're carrying information about what the universe looked like in the past. And so if the expansion of the universe were slowing down, which is what you would expect if it only contained matter, this is something that comes out of general relativity. So if the universe, if the expansion is slowing down, that means it was expanding faster in the past. And so if you, say, pick a certain time, so a horizontal slice of this plot, and say, what velocity do I expect to see a distant galaxy to be moving? It'll be moving a little further to the right, a little faster than you'd expect if things were expanding at a constant rate. So changes in the expansion rate over time result in lines peeling away from a straight line in this plot, with the difference becoming more extreme as you look further into the past. And measuring this kind of relationship is how the presence of dark energy, the accelerated expansion, was discovered in the first place. This was a measurement made in the late 90s by a couple different groups studying a particular type of supernova called type 1a supernova. These things are special because they are, roughly speaking, these are stellar explosions that are always at the same intrinsic luminosity, or at least that we can calibrate so we can treat them as if they're at the same intrinsic luminosity. And so we call them standard candles because in the same way that if you have like a 60 watt light bulb or a very particular type of candle, if you know how bright it is intrinsically, you can use how bright it looks to you to tell you how far away it is. So the light bulb moving further away will look dimmer. We can also use things called standard rulers, where if you have a feature of a known size, like physical size, it'll look smaller as it's further away. And so there are certain features in the distribution of galaxies. The acronym is BAO, telling you what the acronym is, doesn't actually clarify what these are. But there's a feature of a particular size in the distribution of galaxies that we can use as another, as a standard ruler for measurements of distance. And this plot on the right is arranged in the same way as the sketch plot on the other side, showing the measurements we actually make. So here the vertical axis is showing a distance measure in the form of the apparent brightness of supernova. And then the horizontal axis is the Doppler redshift of cosmological objects, which, so the spectra or the colors of astronomical objects will be shifted in the direction to make their colors appear redder due to their the velocity with which they're moving away from us for cosmological expansion. So when working on measurements, we're looking at distance versus velocity, just in slightly different terminology or different quantities. And what we find when we measure this, with supernova, and these are some older data, but there are updates to this that hold up with this, we find that up until a couple billion years ago, the expansion of the universe was in fact slowing down, but in the last couple billion years, we actually see acceleration. And this was, led to the discovery that we need some non-diluting stuff, which we call dark energy, we don't know what it is, to drive an accelerating expansion in late time. So that's the quick overview of expansion. So I'm going to jump into talking about structure growth now. This is a more sophisticated version of the little cartoon timeline of the universe I showed earlier, that in particular is highlighting different observables we can look at associated with structure growth. So as Matt was talking about, on the far left here, you have something happening in the early universe, potentially a model of inflation, which seeds tiny density fluctuations. After inflation ends, those density fluctuations will grow under the influence of gravity, because gravity will pull mass into regions where there's more mass. And so you go from a universe that's nearly uniform, tiny fluctuations. They grow over time. One key observation that we can access those is the fact that about 400,000 years after the Big Bang, the universe first cooled enough to form stable atoms and released a bunch of light that was formerly really interacting with all the charged particles in the universe. We observe that light today as something called the cosmic microwave background, and there are slight temperature fluctuations in the light of the cosmic microwave background that are caused by density fluctuations at early time. So if we make a precise measurement of these temperature fluctuations, we get a handle on what the density fluctuations looked like at the early universe. And as we turn the clock forward, those density fluctuations grow, forming large-scale structure in the universe and eventually over densities that include the dark matter and ordinary visible matter. And eventually you get galaxies forming in the really high density regions. So if we want to measure what the matter distribution looks like in the late universe, we look at those galaxies. So our model will describe the distribution of total matter, which is mostly dark matter. The tricky thing is that dark matter is invisible, so we have to use galaxies to infer the properties of the total distribution of matter. So there are a couple ways you can approach this, but you can broadly split galaxy surveys into two different kinds, so two different ways of gathering information about where galaxies are in space. So our goal is to make a large map, ideally three-dimensional, of where galaxies are, and you can use either a spectroscopic survey or an imaging survey. So a spectroscopic galaxy survey, is the idea behind these is that you pick a bunch of galaxies to target in the sky, and you point an optical fiber at each one. And for each galaxy, you measure a detailed spectrum of the different colors of the light coming from that galaxy. The motivation for doing this is if you have a spectrum measurement, you can get a really precise measurement for that Doppler redshift, which gives you a line of sight coordinate for how far away the galaxy is from you. So, you know, we know where galaxies are in two dimensions on the sky because we can point at them. And then that third dimension comes from the spectra. And I've listed a couple examples of spectroscopic surveys. One that's really exciting that started up this past year that some people at Perimeter work on is called DESI. This survey is going to aim to measure about 35 million galaxy spectra in the next few years. And this image here is a picture of the DESI focal plane, which is 5,000 little robot arms pointing optical fibers at galaxies. Yeah, they were constructing some of these down the hall from my grad school office. It was kind of pretty fun to walk by and watch them putting some of them together. One of the past survey that has been a really valuable data set for people is one called the BOSS survey, and this is a spectrum from that. And an upcoming space-based spectroscopic survey, is called Euclid, which is due to be launched sometime next year. It'll also have a photometric survey, but I'm putting it under the spectroscopic sample because that's really exciting there as well. In contrast to spectroscopic surveys, imaging surveys, you're not measuring spectra for galaxy. You are taking pictures of the sky with a giant digital camera on a telescope. And so you actually get images like this picture here. So the fact that you're not taking spectra means it's a bit harder to measure distances for galaxies. And so we can get a rough estimate of that by taking these images with a couple different color filters on the telescope and getting an estimate based on how bright a galaxy looks in like five different color ranges, or the number varies depending on the survey. But you're going to get cruder distance measurement. But the benefits here is that because you're not measuring a full spectra, you don't need to spend as much time on each individual galaxy, so you can observe more galaxies. And another thing that you can do is that you can measure the apparent shape of the galaxies, which I'll dig into in just a second. So we're going to be spending more time on imaging surveys because that's what I work on. So the dark energy survey is a imaging survey that finished taking data in 2019. We collected images of 200 million galaxies. And the cosmology analysis is ongoing, which is what I'm often busy with. Some other actively ongoing imaging surveys are known as the KID survey, HSC survey, which had a big data release about a week ago, and the Union survey, which a lot of people I know at University of Waterloo are actively involved in. And then there are several exciting upcoming photometrics or imaging surveys, but one that I'm particularly excited in because I'm involved in it is the Vera Rubin LSST. I think it's Legacy Survey of Space and Time. It's an acronym that has changed what it stands for a couple times, but I think that's the current status. And the goal of Rubin is to operate over 10 years and measure data for 20 billion galaxies. So I'm going to shift gears a little bit to talk in a little more detail about how we go about using data from the Dark Energy Survey to say something about dark energy. As the name implies, that's one of the key goals of the experiment.
Can I ask you a question about how they're logistically done?
Yeah.
So the big spectroscopic and imaging surveys, they're, you know, funded and everyone puts together their proposal, and then all the data is publicly available.
It depends on the survey. So LSST is going to be, I think, sort of unique in that the data will become public very quickly, but there are some like process data products which might come out later. I guess I can speak to DES because I know that one the best. There's a proprietary period, and then once the collaboration releases their official results, all the data products are made public. So there's a bit of a delay.
Part of it, you've got access to it for that pre-launch, pre-event release.
Yes. Yeah, and contributing to the official results.
And then work with that data.
Exactly. Yeah, so I believe, so for DES, our cosmology results and all the data are public for the first half of the survey, the first 3 years, and the processing for the full collection is in process now.
Okay.
And the photo on the bottom right here is, in contrast with the DESI 5000 robot arms focal plane, is a DES focal plane, which is CCD chips in a circle about this big. So it's the same kind of technology that's in a digital camera, just a bit thicker to be more sensitive to red light, because galaxies we care about are redshifted. And this is on the Blanco telescope at the CTIO Observatory in Chile. So just to give a little bit more of an overview of what the Dark Energy Survey is, it's a collaborative effort with about 400 people involved in this collaboration from a number of different institutions. It's an international collaboration. And over those 6 years, we gathered data about the positions and colors and shapes of galaxies on a patch of the sky that's about an eighth of the total sky. And this took 758 nights of observing, and the sort of time in which the survey operated and the number of observing nights meant that a lot of people were needed for observing shifts, so they even let people who mainly work on theory go push buttons on a telescope. So this was one of the highlights of my professional career. I got to go spend some time at the telescope. And a thing that I think really was impressed upon me while I was there is like seeing the data come in raw from the telescope, and it looks messy, and there's cosmic ray blotches on the CCD measurements. I'm somebody who usually works with the data in a very processed state, and it like really underlines to me, and therefore I'm trying to underline to you, that it is a big collaborative effort to go from these like pixel measurements of the telescope all the way to constraints on dark energy. So I kind of have the privilege to work at the end of that and like carry the fruits of this collaborative labor over to try and constrain cosmological models. But there are a number of steps that I'm dramatically glossing over to get there. But so let's I'm going to talk a little bit schematically through what data we used in the analysis that I work on. So got our telescope. We look out at the universe. We want to measure the properties of the distribution of total matter, which is illustrated here with these sort of squiggly dark blue lines. We're observing galaxies, which are these yellow and red blobs in the picture. And with an imaging survey where we're measuring galaxy shapes, we have a couple different ways we can try and be sensitive to that total matter density. And one of those things is that we're sensitive to the effects of gravitational lensing. So the idea here is you can pick a sample of galaxies that are very distant. So those are the yellow ones in the picture. And as their light travels to you, it's going to be traveling through these under and over densities of that large scale structure, matter over densities and under densities. And that light will get deflected as it travels through the gravitational fields of those density fluctuations. And that'll result in slight distortions to the apparent galaxy shapes. And because like clumpier matter will cause more, acts as like a stronger lens, the statistical properties of those shape distortions will give you information about the distribution and statistical properties of that those matter density fluctuations between you and the yellow source galaxies. And in particular, if we work with an assumption for now that the intrinsic shapes of the galaxies are sort of randomly oriented, you can look at any alignment between the shapes will be from this kind of lensing effect. So you can kind of think of this as two galaxies that are close to one another on the sky. Their light's going to go through more similar chunks of the universe, and they'll experience more similar distortion. So their distortions, their shapes will be aligned. And so you can look at the alignment of galaxy shapes as a function of how far apart they are on the sky. I will note that this is a very exaggerated cartoon. So we refer to the measurement week as weak lensing. And it's weak in the sense that the changes to the apparent galaxy shapes are only something like 0.1%. So they're tiny, tiny shapes. So if you just observe a couple galaxies, you're not going to be able to detect whether this is happening or not. And so that's why we go after these like large samples of like 100 million galaxies. Yes?
Is it possible that any of the correlations observed in the weak lensing of orientation is due to those galaxies having interacted?
That's a very good question. Yes. This is one of our major headaches in this analysis. So one of the things, I'll mention this on a later slide, but one of the things we have to include in our model is a model for the extent to which tidal interactions from galaxies would mean that they're actually physically aligned. Because if you don't account for that, you might think you're seeing a weak lensing signal when you're really just seeing these tidal alignments of galaxies. That's a good question. I think there was another hand.
You're comparing the orientation of the apparent orientation of the galaxies.
Yep.
Assuming that if they are near each other, they're being locked in a similar way. But doesn't that assume that their inherent orientation is also similar?
So the idea here with ignoring the first question here is if you assume they're just randomly oriented, if you look at a bunch of just random ovals on the sky and look at like, are they pointing in the same direction or not? If they're randomly oriented and you measure enough pairs of them, that correlation will be zero. And so it takes sort of some similar effect impacting their shapes to get sort of that to not wash out in sort of random noise.
So you need a larger ensemble.
Exactly, yeah.
So I'm just trying to imagine this. So when you're trying to unpick the dark matter, presumably those correlations are going through loads of patches.
Mm-hmm.
So how?
Yeah, so I think in practice, and people have tested this with like simulations. In practice, I think it's a pretty good model for the deflection if you just model each photon being deflected or each light ray being deflected like once. So roughly speaking, the amount of distortion is just related to like the total integrated mass density along the line of sight. There's some subtlety there and you can go to more sophisticated calculations, but roughly speaking, this amount of this lensing is if you project all the mass onto like the sky, there's an overdensity here, there's, it's going to act like a lens.
So in one arc, you can tell how much dark matter is inside that one arc, but you can't tell along the length where that...
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, with the caveat that really with any individual arc, you can't really tell because we need a lot of statistical power to see this very faint effect. But yeah, that's a very good point. This is something where you can, you're sensitive to the total amount of matter doing the lensing, so the dark matter as well as visible. But yeah, you're not getting that much three-dimensional information. So we can use the fact that we have other observables at hand, and we can try and select another sample of galaxies that are kind of intermediate distance, that some of them are going to be in the structures doing that lensing. And we can use the fact that galaxies form in overdensity. So if you look at how clustered galaxies are to one another, so like, are they more likely to be close to each other versus far away compared to if they were just randomly distributed on the sky, that gives you some information about how the underlying matter density is clustered. And then also, you've got red galaxy positions, yellow galaxy shapes. You can look at the relationship between them.
So a question and a comment.
Question,
this is all your artwork, right?
Yes.
That's very nice.
Okay. All right. Well, okay. Well, so these are the kinds of measurements that we use. And, you know, I'm referring to these sort of statistical correlations. And I'll note that when we use this to say something about cosmology, we're not predicting that we expect to see a galaxy right there or a blob of matter there. We use these relationships with how likely are shapes going to be aligned as a function of separation in the sky to define a kind of like summary statistic. So we compress the information of the shapes and positions and colors of these 100 million galaxies down into about 450 numbers. And it's those numbers that we can make predictions for given a cosmological model. And given a cosmological model, we have some input parameters, for example, how much matter there is in the universe. And we can turn the dials and change those values of parameters, look for where they fit our measurements of this, these clustering statistics well or not, to report constraints in contour plots that look like this. So this plot is showing, the gray contour is showing DES constraints from these galaxy clustering and weak lensing measurements on two parameters of our model. Horizontal axis is matter density, so the matter, size of the matter piece of the pie chart we were looking at earlier. And then the vertical axis is this parameter S8, which we use to quantify basically how clumpy the universe is. Larger value means clumpier, lower value means more uniform. And the contours are showing, based on our comparison of our predictions and our measurements, the inner contour, the data tells us we have a 68% confidence that the real number is in there. The outer contour shows where we have 95% confidence the result is. And specifically, these results are for sort of the simplest standard cosmological model, so assuming dark energy is a cosmological constant. Given these measurements, there's a lot of ways we can try to approach testing the simplest model. And one way is just comparing our measurements to measurements of different observables, say of expansion history, or here I'm showing constraints from this light that was released from the early universe, the cosmic microwave background. And so the way to read this plot is that the red contour is showing if you constrain your cosmological model parameters in the early universe, and given our assumptions of cosmological constant, general relativity, cold dark matter, et cetera, what we expect to see those density fluctuations to look like in late time. So comparing these two contours lets us test the ability of our model to predict structure formation in the full history of the universe. And so these are a little bit offset in this particular plot and with these particular measurements. That offset isn't really statistically significant, but something that's really tantalizing in the field of cosmology these days is that there are a number of different measurements other than just the dark energy survey that are also finding slight offsets in the same direction. And so this could just be a statistical fluke. It could be the first hint at something that we might know more about as we gather more precise data. And so there are a lot of ways you can approach that. And I'm going to skip over a slide or two, but I will note that one of the things that I primarily work on that I'm happy to talk to people about is looking at models beyond lambda CDM, so like time dynamic dark energy or different possible modifications of gravity or changes to your dark matter model, and using the same data to constrain that. And yeah, as I note, we need to worry about things other than cosmology when doing this. So we need to remove scales where our models aren't accurate. We need to worry about things like astrophysical, like galaxy formation effects. And one of the things we care about and do in our analysis is that we have to account for the fact that these analyses are done by people. And we want to make sure that like our expectations or numbers that we care about, say comparing late and early universe measurements, can't even unconsciously bias the decisions we make and how to do the analysis. So we do this in a blind analysis protocol where we transform our data to hide the results from ourselves until we like finalize all the decisions. And that's a piece that I particularly work on. So I'm also happy to chat with people more. Okay, I will hop to a conclusion. So I heard Luna did an analogy with learning about animals with dark matter, so I figured I'd follow suit. So the analogy here that goes with the conclusion is we would like to learn about the fundamental physics affecting the large-scale universe, or in the cartoon, some animal that we're trying to learn about. And we have a model for it, for example, a lambda CD, or a standard cosmological model, some description of dark energy and dark matter, that we've built based on observations of, say, expansion history and structure growth. And as we make more precise measurements, compare and combine different ways of testing that model, different observations, our hope is to find some clues for building more fundamental descriptions of the pieces of our model. And so that's the main takeaway. Additional takeaways, if you have mental energy for remembering more things, is that this is the outcome of a big collaborative effort. There's a lot of care and a lot of the work that goes into this is making sure that we understand model assumptions to make sure our results are accurate as well as precise. And then, yeah, there's more exciting galaxy surveys to come and more to say on this. So thank you.
So move on pretty quickly, but like one or two more questions.
This is going to come up on the side of Planck or the local supernovae in terms of the crisis in cosmology and
crisis. Yeah, so these like galaxy clustering and weak lensing data just aren't actually very sensitive at all to the Hubble constant. The fact that we're able to constrain the matter density means that if we combine them with some other measurement, we can constrain it. So if you combine it with this BAO standard ruler observation of expansion history and some constraints on like early universe nucleosynthesis, it ends up agreeing with Planck. That's information coming from a combination of experiments, not rather than this one individually.
Can I ask you an unrelated question?
Yeah.
If you look at all the galaxies in the outer, whatever you're looking at in those pictures, do they all spin in the same direction?
I do not know.
Is it correlated with the polarization of light that we get? It's like 4% polarized too much one way, right?
I can answer that because we did that with Galaxy 2, the Zooniverse project, that you get that you classify all the shapes. That was with SDSS, which is a much smaller survey. It was a million galaxies. And we asked people to say they spiraling clockwise or anti-clockwise to see if there was some cosmological reason that they would spiral one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
At first, there was a bias in the data. There was a sort of an excess of clockwise, but it turned out that was a psychological bias as people looked at it. Mm-hmm. They were more likely to see a clockwise spiral than an anti-clockwise spiral.
But the light is more slightly polarized right-handed than left-handed by 4% or something like that.
Yeah, but that doesn't affect galaxy morphology.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting point.
Yeah, with our data, we don't have polarization data, and I will note that of this 100 million galaxies we're observing, like this is actually an image from DES. Well, this is not a very clear image. But a lot, we're looking very far back and we're measuring shapes of a huge sample of galaxies. So a lot of them were probably not even resolved enough to be able to gauge rotation.
Yeah, the rotation comes from like the angular momentum of whatever formed it. So the light's coming from the stars, and the stars are just on whatever tracks they end up on. So it's something to do with the polarization of the light.
Well, this was awesome. Thank you both for taking the time to chat with us. Will you be at the mixer tomorrow morning? So we'll have time to ask more questions then. Mm-hmm.